This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting today with Ruben Ramirez of Reedley, California. Pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook to see what he looks like now and what he looked like when he served with the 88th Infantry Division, an all-draftee division during World War II. He spent his time battling elite German troops in the mountains of Italy, wounded three different times. When we left off, Ruben was telling us how hard it was in the dark of night and how those experiences nearly 70 years ago still affect him in a palpable way today.
When there were times you actually got to sleep, I imagine the conditions you had to deal with weren't very favorable. Were you digging a hole on the side of a hill or what?
Yeah, wherever possible, find some defensive position where you could be safe. Or if there's a barn or houses around that we can get into. All we had maybe a blanket or a coat or jacket, something like that. But one time we walked into a factory that had nothing but rolls of cloth. The guys just cut them up and put them on the floor and fell asleep on them. They ruined a lot of material there, but that's the fate of war for whoever owned it. Because we wanted comfort. We didn't want to sleep on a wet floor or a hard cement floor. So they just cut pads about 3-4 inches thick to lay down on. Nobody ever reprimanded us for that.
Probably slept a lot better that night.
Yeah, I was more comfortable because usually I would fall asleep with shoes on and everything, all my clothes, and all I had to do was cover my face because if I kept my face warm, the rest of the body would be warm.
One of the things I've read about and had other veterans tell me concerning the 88th Infantry Division is that a good chunk of that division was still fighting at the end of the war. Some of them even after Germany had surrendered. Where were you for those first 8 days of May?
As soon as we stopped fighting, we went into occupation in a small town. The Germans had called Brixen, and Italian it was Bressanone, and we went into occupation there. We had guards on the road to get any Germans coming down the road or going up the road if they're trying to go back to country. What we did, if they come down the road, we'd put them together and send them to a prison camp in the Po Valley.
So there were still Germans coming out of the woods after the surrender had been signed?
And one time, there were three of us that had a little German Jeep, and we went out riding down the road. We made a curb, and there was a column of German tanks coming down the road. And it's a good thing we're not fighting them now, because right away they stopped. We pulled to the side of the road, and we waited for them to start passing us. Comrade, cigarettes. They wanted cigarettes, you know. And I guess there was a captain or a colonel at first tank. He spoke beautiful English. He asked how to get to a point of surrender, you know. And we told him to go on into town, to the center of town by the railroad station, and they would take care of him. So in the time the Germans were going by, got any cigarettes, you know. They were friendly at that time because they weren't fighting. And there was about 8 tanks in that line, in that convoy, plus all the manpower they had. But it was amazing, you know, just to see the power that they had with those tanks. And you think, we had a fight against that. If they would have had that in some of our positions or some of the battles that we fought facing us, you know, it was awful. 88 millimeters. It's a loud bang, you shoot, and then it's a hit right away. It's a high-velocity rifle, and that would scare the pants off you. It did one time, too, because we were in the slope of a hill, and the lieutenant told us to dig in, so we made our trenches there, foxholes. And we were there for half of the day, and it started to get dusk. All of a sudden, a tank across on the other hillside, further away from us, we saw a tank on the skyline. And we just said, well, I hope they don't see us, because we're in the forward slope, and they can see us as well as we can see them. And they shot at us. So right away, the lieutenant hollered, let's get out of here, let's move. So there was the first casualty of a war that I saw, because one of the friends was in the hole and a shell landed right beside him. And there was nothing left but of him but the corpse, the body. Everything else was cut out.
So just his torso, everything else was blown away. And so that's the worst thing you had to look at in the war, is that what you're saying?
There, but for the grace of God. Yeah, that always with me. But we got out of there, and some P-47 came flying around, and they spotted the tank and shot at him, but I think the tank got away from him.
Was there much celebration among your ranks when you found out the Germans had surrendered?
Well, not just a lot of shouting and shooting and everything else. And some guy had a bunch of flares, so we shot them up in the air, but they got mad at us for that because they started fires. They didn't like that when they landed. They started some fires.
I know you had that occupation duty there for a while. I imagine you encountered occasionally some Italian civilians. What was that like? Did they express some appreciation for what you guys did?
They treated us nice. First days, they were very accommodating as far as going to give us wines. They always gave off of the wine. And some people would even bring a bowl of spaghetti. As we stayed there, the longer we stayed there, we developed a connection that we would give them our clothes for laundry and stuff like that. And then pay them with cigarettes or with bread or whatever we can get from the kitchen with food for them, you know. So they were taken care of, but we took care of them, and they did the work for us.
When the war in Europe ended, and I know you had that occupation duty, but was there a concern on your part that you might get sent to Japan?
That when they tried to get me to re-enlist right away, they started offering, making me a sergeant and giving me a bonus and everything else. Then it hit me. I said, no, if I do that, then in the war in Japan continues, I'm going to end up there. That's the only thought that I gave it then when they start offering. But I told them I had my discharge points already, because we've got to discharge an amount of points you got for being overseas and stuff like that. So when I told the sergeant, I don't care what you offer me. I got my points. I'm ready to go home.
And what was it like to go home? What do you remember about that?
Well, pretty quiet. The family didn't expect me to show up when I did show up, but they were very, very happy, celebrated. You know, they'll come over for a big dinner and everything else. And one thing during the occupation in the town, the colonel moved herself headquarters into the hotel there, and he wanted sentries at the door. So he had a battalion inspection, and he picked 12 guys for guard duty. Spick and span, he wanted the best, I guess. I was one of them that he picked, you know. So we just stand at the door a couple hours, and we were off for a couple of the rest of the day and stuff like that. They stopped doing that, and I was going to report back to my squad when another battalion inspection came out. He couldn't get military police in there, so he wanted to get special police to patrol the town with some Italian police. So and again, he had a big inspection and everything else, and again, I was one of the guys they picked to be on that special police, which we did nothing but just walk around town. One day we walked 4 hours, we were off the rest of the day. Next day we walked 2 hours and we were off the rest of the day. The third day we were off. We didn't have to report to anybody. But we had a lieutenant in charge of us, and that's all he said, I don't care what you do. I just want to know where you are and how I can get you as fast as I can if I need you. It's all right. So that's all we had. We could go to any company we wanted to eat at their facilities, go over there and watch the people training and everything else and make them jealous of us. That lasted a couple of months. We were bivouacking at school, so I reported back to the school, threw my bag on the floor and had to report to the sergeant. And I heard him and the lieutenant talking, and the lieutenant asked me, has everybody gone to Venice for their leave, 2 weeks leave? So the sergeant said, yep, everybody's gone, sir, and I got my records all set up. He said, and I hollered, I haven't been to Venice. The lieutenant said, who's that? His sergeant looks out. He said, oh, that's Ramirez. He's just reporting back for special police. Has he gone to Venice? The sergeant says, no. Get him on the next truck. So I didn't even unpack my duffel bag. I just threw it on the truck, and I was out of there to go to Venice for 2 weeks. I met some guys there, Air Force guys, that we chummed up to go around traveling and everything, sightseeing, spend time on the beach.
I think you earned all that with everything you went through before then. And speaking of what you've been through, you mentioned having to have the lights on at night and all of that. Something you've dealt with for most of your life. How hard was it after you came home to get back into the swing of things, to adjust to civilian life again after this had been your existence for all this time?
It was hard because I'm classified with PTSD. When I got discharged, nobody said anything about PTSD or mental fatigue or anything like that. All they said was, if you're wounded, make out a claim. So I did. But nothing about the mental condition that we came out of. Not like they're taking care of the Vietnam veterans now. I've gone through the whole track of sleepless nights, nervousness, dreams, anxieties, everything connected with it. I went through that coming out of the service the first few years there, but I never knew what was wrong with me. You know, I was obsessive. I was on the edge all the time and hollering at night, getting up, giving a security check. And finally, when I met Tony Pacheco, he started with my paperwork, and that was in 2008. Yeah, it started. So actually, I missed out all those years that I should have been covered for it. But not knowing about it, I had trouble with my wounds. I went to the Long Beach Hospital, but they never asked me anything else except taking care of the wound. But if they would have had anything to do mentally, they could have put it on paper, then my claims would have gone back that far. But since it wasn't, it had to be investigated and everything else, and I had to show proof and everything what I had. So 2008 was as far as they went.
What kind of difference has it made for you these last 5 years to actually have that recognized, to be able to talk to other guys who've gone through the same thing? What has it done for you?
You get peace of mind. Every other Tuesday I go to the VA and we have a session with World War II veterans only. We just talk, express ourselves. And every Friday I go to the VA for an hour, and there it's a general session with PTSD patients. And you have the Korean War, you have the Vietnams, and I'm the only World War II in there. That's, again, expressing yourself and what you go through for the week, the sleep at night. I show my nails when I have an anxiety attack. I show my tail, this is what I do when I'm getting excited. I know when I'm going to have problems, I start messing with my fingernail. And sometimes I carry a fingernail file, so when I know I'm feeling something, it occupies my mind, takes my mind away from what's getting me excited. And then I'm short-tempered. Sometimes little things irritate me, like people. And I know it's going to come, so I have to be able to block it. I hate to, instead of going into it and going to a tantrum and insult people or anything, try to walk away, try to, like we say, we bunker, go into our own little self to bunker. So we're out of the situation until it's over.
I'm glad you're able to share that with us, because so many of us have no idea some of the things that people like you have been through, and really you did it for us. You put yourself in that situation for our sake. So thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us in a real way about what you've dealt with. You have those regular meetings. I understand you're pretty busy here in Reedley too at the senior center. What do you do over there?
Volunteer every morning at the senior center for lunch for the senior centers. I do the recording to order the lunches and check them in when they come in for lunch, and my friend there does the serving of the food and everything. But I'm also chairman of the Senior Reedley Seniors Incorporated.
Why do you do all that? What do you get out of it?
Keeps me occupied half of the day. I don't have to sit in front of a boob tube all day. We have painting classes. I joined a painting class, which I had never painted before. We have our pastor, Harold, there. He likes to paint. He's a good painter, and he's an instructor. And then, like he says, you can't make a mistake on it. It dries, we'll paint over it. You'll never know. Don't be afraid to do what you want to do on it, because it can always be corrected. But we keep busy.
Have you been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. yet?
Not yet, but I'm on a planned trip for October.
What do you think that's going to be like to visit this memorial, not just to you and 16 million Americans, but the centerpiece of that memorial is 4,000 gold stars signifying 400,000 Americans, one of them your brother, who died in World War II. When you think about that number, you think about going there and seeing that, what does that signify to you?
To me, it was a shameful loss of life to it happen. But it happened because the mindset of other people that couldn't talk things out and be more thoughtful of the civilization. But it happened, so it had to be done. Luckily, we were better than they were.
I'm not trying to make you more emotional. But this is so real, and so many of us today go along with our lives, and we don't realize what people like you went through. And when you think about your brother, and you think about your own life and the things you've had to deal with, do you ever think about your brother and who he would have been, what he would have done in his life, what kind of difference he would have made?
I do think about that. I've thought that a lot. He was a good leader. We always had a bunch of friends around with him. That's where the little Hank and Big Hank nickname came out, because he had a lot of friends.
Well, Mr. Ramirez, we're out of time today, but thank you so much. I'm so excited that Central Valley Honor Flight is going to get you to Washington, D.C. and the World War II Memorial. The stories you've shared with us today give us a little perspective on what that memorial is all about. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and thank you for being here.
That's Ruben Ramirez of the 88th Infantry Division. Next time, we're going to hear from a veteran who served in the 87th Division and survived 16 weeks missing in action. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.